servant rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 1st, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matt Duss, foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, on the ongoing war in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia shells civilian areas in Kharkiv as a massive convoy, military vehicles, heads towards Kyiv. Sanctions on Russia mount. Meanwhile, talks between Ukraine and Russia go nowhere. Biden to deliver a State of the Union address tonight. We'll talk about that conflict and reorient the Build Back Better bill. California and Oregon and New York City drop their school mask mandates as the CDC rejiggers its metrics to make COVID fade away. So easy, like magic. All Republicans and Joe Manchin, maybe that's redundant, stop an abortion rights law in the Senate. No word on civilian casualties in the weekend U.S. drone strike on Somalia. Republican leadership finally releases a statement that its members attending a white nationalist conference was wrong. Texas has its primary today. All eyes on Jennifer Cisneros.
Jessica.
Jessica. And her sister Jennifer.
Fingers crossed.
And in other good news, the IPCC issues its bleakest warning yet about global warming. And nobody seems to be doing anything about it. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. It is Tuesday. Joining me as always,
Emily Vigeland.
Emily Vigeland. I know. My back is hurting me, folks. And so I got, like, my normal problem with names, pronunciations, remembering them.
What little capacity you had to apply to names.
Completely
is now
diminished.
To the back.
Gone. Right. Completely gone. So, here it is. It's, I guess, day five of this Russian invasion of Ukraine. And reports through the night that Kharkiv, second biggest city in Ukraine, was shelled in civilian areas. In fact, our own Jack Crosby got, left Kharkiv just before the shelling began. He was on Chris Hayes' program last night, reporting from some distance that they had moved west. And my understanding, and we'll talk to Matt Duss a little bit about this, obviously a lot about this, but my understanding is that after Kharkiv, they will go south to another city and then make their way up to Kyiv, meeting, you know, Belarusian forces. But it's
north, yeah.
Unclear as to, you know, where things stand in Kharkiv. Kharkiv was supposed to fall much quicker because at least people presume the assumption by Putin was that it would fall much quicker because it is closer. It is further to the east. It is more, I guess, ethnically, language-wise,
more
Russian-speaking. I think it's the second. I think it's the largest Russian-speaking city in the country. And there was obviously a miscalculation by Putin's government. I've been trying to articulate this the past couple of days. Well, I guess just yesterday when I was on, but I was I've been trying to articulate this, and Duncan Black at Atrios at Eschaton wrote this up, and this is really important because I think very broad strokes, what has happened is people did not expect, ultimately, I think largely, there to be an invasion. Although, again, one never knows what other players are thinking. But largely, I don't think the Ukrainians thought there was. I mean, the American government certainly seemed to believe that there was going to be an invasion. Or at least they were posturing in that way. We don't know if they were posturing in that way as a way of trying to inhibit an invasion. But Putin clearly had some assumptions about how quickly and how easily this thing would take place, and they were wrong. The Russians have not dedicated nearly their full arsenal, even that they had amassed, on the Ukrainian border, and they're starting to do that, and people are very worried about that. But I don't think anybody, including the Russians, or maybe even the Americans, for that matter, anticipated the blowback. There are two oligarchs, apparently, that are speaking out. There are people in the government that are speaking out. There are protests across Russia. There has been widespread in the West condemnation.
Now China appears to be turning.
There's like, I think there's...
There's a crack in it a bit. They're talking to the Ukrainian authorities.
Exactly. And at the very least, I think it's safe to say that there has been a more of a blowback than one could possibly anticipate, particularly if you remember what happened in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea. There just was nothing that amounted to this. And while I think that's a good thing, it does scare me insofar as that the ghouls who live amongst us in this country, in NATO, in other places, may seize upon this opportunity as a way of getting Putin out. Let me just read what Atrios said, and then we'll get into this, because this is about a clip that we have. Atrios says, de-escalation is a desirable goal, largely and separate from any concept of who is right and who is wrong. And the sad thing is that our politicians, puts an asterisk there, are largely just like us in that they're getting amped up on war fever and Twitter memes. We all want to crush the guy who deserves to be crushed, but getting through this with minimal loss of life should be the priority, not indulging in righteous rage. He writes, I am dumb and not in charge of anything. It is rare that I have any influence on the world at all, but the voice is suggesting that anything other than maximum humiliation of Putin and regime change is unacceptable are growing louder. Hey, maybe they're right, but maybe they are catastrophically wrong.
And I'd add, just as an addendum, the calls for a no-fly zone over Ukraine, also disastrous.
This is all part of that same thing.
Yeah.
And he says the asterisk, it seems the Biden people are pretty good, at least so far. Some Dems are not, and Republicans are switching from Putin is good to Putin is history's greatest monster is not actually helpful. Many UK politicians are far dumber and crueler than our own. Hard to believe, but very true. The point being that there is one thing to posture to avoid a war, and then what happens is when they see that Putin is actually going to pay a major price for this.
He's a wounded animal in their eyes.
He is a wounded animal. But what the idea is at that point is, how do you wound him more at this mm-hmm. point?
It's time for the kill shot. Some of these ghouls are thinking.
But who will be the bullet? Here is Hillary Clinton on a Rachel Maddow show. Believe me. I wouldn't necessarily give a limb, but I'd give a lot to not have to discuss Hillary Clinton, regardless of what your feelings were as to the election, et cetera, et cetera. I was very upset that Michael Dukakis lost, but I did not, want to watch him 5 or 6 years later, opining on these type of things. Here is Hillary Clinton on Rachel Maddow's show, and I'll tell you what is really, really disturbing about this. Play the clip.
But remember, the Russians invaded Afghanistan back in 1980, and although no country went in, they certainly had a lot of countries supplying arms and advice and even some advisors to those who were recruited.
Pause 1 second. So just for those of you who are younger and don't know the history, when she says a lot of countries, really, basically, it's the United States. I mean, it may be our allies. They're doing it at our behest and et cetera, et cetera. But we armed the Mujahideen. We paid for the madrasas in Pakistan to develop the Taliban.
Isn't there a movie starring Tom Hanks about this?
Yes, Charlie Wilson's War.
Brave Mujahideen fighters.
And also, this is how bin Laden grows.
Yes.
So her
use of the passive voice is doing a lot there.
Exactly. Exactly. But her point being that it severely damaged the Soviet Union. So just keep that in mind. This is the mode of thought that is going on here, that sucking them into a quagmire may actually debilitate the existing government. This is what she is articulating here.
Russia. It didn't end well for the Russians. There were other unintended consequences, as we know. But the fact is that a very motivated
What were the unintended consequences? Can you imagine
Leave that all unsaid, like, shall
she's
we?
She's just not going to say the word 9 and then afterwards 11.
Right. There's a little bit of blowback and, of course, the destruction of the country and the Taliban taking over.
Occupation after that for 20 years.
But put that aside. And why does she want to put that aside? Because she's making a very specific point. If you draw them in, maybe this becomes a quagmire that ends up destroying the country. That's the point she's trying to make here.
Funded and armed insurgency basically drove the Russians out of Afghanistan. Obviously, the similarities are not ones that you should bank on, because the terrain, the development in urban areas, et cetera, is so different. But I think that is the model that people are now looking toward. And there can be sufficient armaments that get in, and they should be able to get in along some of the borders between other nations and Ukraine, and keep the Ukrainian, both their military and their citizen volunteer soldiers supplied, that can continue to stymie Russia. Now, let's be clear that Russia has overwhelming military force. But of course, they did in Afghanistan as well. They also brought a lot of air power to Syria. It took years to finally defeat Syria in terms of the insurgencies, the democratic forces, as well as others who battled the Russians, the Syrians, and the Iranians. If you're fighting for your homeland, you're fighting for your family, you're fighting for your ideals, that's far more powerful than sending in these poor.
All right. Couple of things. First on, Yeah, you can't bank on this because there's a reason why they called Afghanistan the graveyard of empires.
Yeah.
They don't call that in Ukraine because of all those differences about Afghanistan. But do not misunderstand what she's saying here. There is an option that she could be saying here. She could be saying the key is if there is enough resistance, maybe we can find an off ramp for Putin so that we can save people's lives. And that is, she could be pushing that, but she's not. What she's saying is maybe if we arm Ukraine enough, it will create a quagmire. Now, granted,
there are unintended consequences.
There's unintended consequences, and the Russian military has overwhelming force. But maybe this could be a protracted, years-long thing where they will be stymied, and we will see a redo of what happened to the Soviet Union happened with Russia. And when she is talking about when Emma says, you know, the kill shot is available. Understand what she's saying here. The bullet are Ukrainians.
Yeah. And it's a country of 44 million people that she's kind of like toying around in her mind with as being a ground for a proxy battle, and which in her ideal world and in the people that think like her ends in Putin's power being greatly diminished.
Listen,
which is psychotic.
If I could press a button right now, and Vladimir Putin was ejected into the stratosphere, I would do it without hesitation. But the bottom line is, and the reason why I read that paragraph from Atreus, is that we should be looking at de-escalation not because we have any truck for Putin, but because you want to save human lives.
Not turn them into, sign them up for 10 years of guerrilla warfare.
Exactly. Exactly.
And with the end, you know, being as clean as she's anticipating that it will be, or she's claiming that it will be, even though she talked about how, you know, it didn't work out so well in Afghanistan, but it might work this time. Just a little bit different.
I mean, the bottom line is just the idea that you're going to, you're encouraging Ukraine to turn into a years long insurgency for the sake, and using the example again,
right?
Using the example of Afghanistan, because aside from the unintended consequences that she sort of brushes away, the Taliban, 9/11,
yada, 20-year war,
this and that, the only thing that really happened there, besides the death and destruction of many Afghans and the destruction of Afghanistan, was that it led to the demise of the Soviet Union. So what she's talking about is this is regime change without us really having to do that much. And by us, she means us sitting here in a studio, not the us of the people living in Kyiv or Kharkiv or anywhere in Ukraine.
And this is her way. I mean, like, let's be clear, too, when she goes on Maddow's show to talk about this, when she says this is something people are considering, what do you think that her designs are here? It's to pressure the Biden administration publicly
without
to get more involved.
Without a doubt.
So just let's, I mean, that's why she's on Maddow's show.
Bad. That's my comment.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. Bad. I think bad is accurate. We should say, you know, we mentioned that we were going to talk about this briefly. There's no update on the drone strike in Somalia. The U.S. military has said that there's probably no civilian casualties.
Oh, well, good.
So that's good.
I mean, that's something I think we need to pay attention to on the left right now is The Intercept's done some good reporting on it, but it's sparse because the information coming out of not just Somalia, but broader Eastern Africa and our operations there it's just, it's completely opaque and deliberately so. So like when we were having a larger question about, or a larger conversation about war and what that means, this is a reminder that we're still engaged throughout the globe in places like Somalia. And we have zero concept, at least it's not really reported on much in the Western press, of what those consequences are.
Couple of housekeeping notes. We have sold out of the live show in Brooklyn. We have decided that we will live stream it.
Big
yes,
news.
Big news. How much are we going to live stream it for? Like 12? What did it say? $12.50? You can get more than 50% off that price via a coupon code that is in the AM Quickie. So if you sign up for the AM Quickie at amquickie.com, this is the cleverest marketing thing I have ever engaged in.
Who came up with it?
I actually did. I think I read about it somewhere, or somebody else was doing it, and I was like, oh, wait, we could do that.
No, it's a good idea.
It is a good
virtual
idea.
Virtual tickets.
Well, no, not and the virtual tickets. Part. I didn't come up with that part.
Oh.
No, that was, I noticed that Francesca's doing it. And I should say, the Bituation Room is happening a week from Thursday.
Yeah.
In at the same place at the Bell House in Brooklyn. I will be there.
And I'll be on vacation. I'm sad I'm missing it.
But I will be there on stage. So check it out in Brooklyn. You can find tickets. We'll put a link to that. But in the meantime, if you want to stream the live show in Brooklyn on March 26th, you can do so by getting a steep discount by signing up for the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. We just want you to check it out because you will enjoy it. Corey and Jack are doing a bang up job. Of course, Jack right now is in Ukraine reporting from the ground there. Writing some amazing pieces in Rolling Stone magazine. So check that out. And also, this goes out to our Discord. Over 5,000 people in the Discord now.
Wow.
Yep.
5K.
That's right. 5K. 5,000. It's another way of saying that. Mm. Let's do just a little bit of preview for the State of the Union tonight. Obviously, Biden is going to talk about what's going in Ukraine. I mean, there's an extraordinary amount of pressure, I think, on the Biden administration from the ghouls who want to use the Ukrainian people as a mechanism for regime change in Russia. I have no problem with Putin not being the authoritarian, more or less dictator of Russia. But the idea that we should encourage a quagmire in Ukraine to do so is inhumane. And there's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure on the Biden administration. Let's play this clip of a Polish, I guess, reporter asking a question of Boris Johnson in Britain. And you know, I don't think this, I think this Polish reporter is completely sincere. And I think it's a genuine expression of angst. Oh, wait, do we have Matt?
I was about to say, okay, we should wait to do this.
Okay.
We'll take a quick break.
Oh, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Duss. All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report here with Emma Vigeland, and joining us, Matt Duss, Foreign Policy Advisor, Senator Bernie Sanders. Matt, good to see you. It's been a long time since you've been on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here, Sam. Thank you.
So I was just saying that we played a clip of Hillary Clinton on Rachel Maddow's show talking about all the unintended there were some unintended consequences of, you know, the money that we poured into Afghanistan to fight the Russians in, I should say at that time, the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. She didn't really outline the unintended consequences, but the big prize was what it did to the then Soviet Union. And many people feel that Afghanistan was a big part of the fall of the Soviet Union in terms of draining it of resources, and suggested that there was an analog, even though the terrain's not the same, the Russians, if there's enough weapons poured into Ukraine, to the Russians' experience in Ukraine. And I want to play this clip for you of a Polish reporter speaking to Boris Johnson, pleading for a no-fly zone, because I think in many respects, these are two forces that are pushing for greater conflict. Here's this clip.
A woman from my team is now in Bila Cerkva, and she is there with two kids. And Russian military is over there, and she's so much afraid that she will be shot. Kharkiv, the city where I was studying, was bombarded today, fully, the downtown square. So you're talking about the stoicism of Ukrainian people, but Ukrainian women and Ukrainian children are in deep fear because of bombs and missiles which are going from the sky. And Ukrainian people are desperately asking for the West to protect our sky. We are asking for the no-fly zone. We are saying in response that it will trigger World War III. But what is the alternative, Mr. Prime Minister? To observe how our children are, instead of planes, are protecting NATO from the missiles and bombs? What's the alternative for the no-fly zone? We have planes here. We have air defense system in Poland, in Romania. NATO has this air defense. At least this air defense could shield the Western Ukraine so that these children with women could come to the border. It's impossible now to cross the border. There are 30 kilometers of lines. Imagine crossing the border with a baby or with two children. I'm so glad that Samantha Power is coming here to the border from the Polish side. Let her come to the border from Ukrainian side and see that. Britain guaranteed our security under Budapest Memorandum. So you're coming to Poland. You're not coming to Kiev, Prime Minister. You're not coming to Lviv because you're afraid. Because NATO is not willing to defend. Because NATO is afraid of the World War III. But it is already started. And these are Ukrainian children who are there taking the hit. You're talking about more sanctions, Prime Minister, but Roman Abramovich is not sanctioned. He's in London. His children are not in the bombardments. His children are there in London. Putin's children are in Netherlands, in Germany, in mansions. Where are all these mansions seized? I don't see that. I see that my family members, that my team members are saying that we are crying. We don't have where to run. This is what is happening, Prime Minister.
Well, thank you.
So, I mean, there's, and you know, nothing that I think you could take issue with in terms of what that woman was saying, outside of the fact that, like, she's presenting this dichotomy of, you know, what are the other options besides World War III? I mean, World War III is a pretty steep, decision to make.
And we should say, too, just really briefly, sorry, Matt, like that a no-fly zone isn't just an imaginary invisible shield over Ukraine. That means shooting down Russian airplanes. And like that is a declaration of war. So I feel like there's very little understanding of that, because when we've implemented no-fly zones, it's usually been over smaller countries where the implications haven't been as grave as this.
Right. And I think that's a great point. And I think, you know, I am encouraged, and, you know, I don't often say that I am encouraged about the way that these kind of foreign policy debates go, especially in situations like this. But I have been encouraged at the number of people who I have seen pointing out what you just did, Emma, right? We are not talking about, we do not have the ability to just create an invisible energy shield around the airspace of Ukraine, unfortunately. When people kind of throw out these terms like no-fly zones, I think, you know, they've heard about them. They've heard about how they've actually done good in the past. So they think it sounds smart for them to say it. But what it requires, what we are talking about, is U.S. and NATO planes and U.S. and NATO artillery and any aircraft weapons shooting down Russian planes. And that is not a step toward war. That is a war with Russia, another nuclear armed state. And that is an extremely serious, thing that we need to understand. And again, that's not to diminish at all what that Polish journalist was saying. I mean, I feel it, and I felt it deeply just now, and we all should. But at the same time, we also have to ask what are going to be the consequences of these kinds of steps that we take, and what are other things that we can do to protect refugees, to protect civilians, and can we do those?
And we should point out that this is, you know, that decision to enter into World War III does not necessarily protect those people anymore. It more than likely,
yes, they will die as well. That is right. And I think that point is, like, so much of the kind of the do something tendency is very understandable, and especially in situations like this. But we need to include in the bucket of do something, there are things that are not just military escalation. You know, certainly military, you know, the military tool is a one that has its place. But I think we need to look at other options here, given some of the very clear consequences of a military escalation.
All right. So let's go backwards. We sort of, you know, skipped ahead, I think, in the context of this conversation. But we were there when we entered it. Give us a sense of how it is that we got to where we are today. I know that's a heavy lift, but give us in broad strokes, your understanding of how we got to this point and how surprising it is that we are at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it's always a challenge, and, of how far back do you go to kind of to lay down the context here. But I'll try to kind of do as best I can. So it's clear that, you know, Putin particularly, but also not just Putin, I think the Russian government, the Russian political echelon have been concerned for a long time of, you know, Ukraine's growing relationship with the West, with Europe, with the United States in particular. This has expressed itself in various ways. I think we can go back to 2014, which was an important moment, the Maidan protests, which arose when kind of the pro-Russia president of Ukraine at the time kind of canceled a Ukraine-Europe trade agreement in favor of a Ukraine-Russia trade agreement. There were mass protests. That president was ousted and replaced with a different one, and Russia clearly saw this as a U.S. orchestrated coup. I think others have made that claim. I don't think it's correct to call it a U.S. orchestrated coup. At the same time, the United States made no secret whatsoever of how they wanted things to turn out at that time. But clearly Putin, you know, he saw that as an escalation and a massive interference on the part of the West and the U.S. in terms of Ukraine's politics. We then saw a little bit later the Russian what was a Russian invasion in 2014, although it was a much more subtle and deniable invasion than the one we are seeing right now. This is, you know, the use of military contractors and militias essentially that were closely affiliated. And I think there's evidence that they were, you know, essentially under the command of the Russian government at the time. But they were not wearing Russian military uniforms. So there was a level of deniability of what was actually going on. So taking over these two oblasts, as they are called, in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. And that was essentially frozen since 2014. But we saw just a week ago, and in the weeks and months leading up to a week ago, you know, starting about a year ago, Russian forces starting to mass at the borders of Ukraine, bringing some, I think it's probably over 170,000 troops ultimately. And then a week ago, Putin kind of laying out this flimsy legal and historical pretext for what he was about to do was just to say that we are recognizing the independence of these two regions, and according to our laws, we have the right and the responsibility of protecting, you know, Russian-speaking citizens in these regions, so I'm using my military to go in there. But at the same time, he also, you know, before the invasion happened, gave an hour-long speech laying out this very expansive and frankly bizarre vision of what he was doing, which is to say, you know, Ukraine is actually not a real country. It's just a part of Russia. Ukrainians aren't a separate nationality. He's claiming to denazify Ukraine. He's also claiming to decommunize Ukraine. And for those, interestingly, you know, people have pointed out that his quote from the past, where he called, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical calamity of the 20th century, what he was laying out was, you know, something that's reaching back even farther than the Soviet Union, was a much kind of imperial conception of you know, the new Russian Empire as he saw it. So I think, you know, people have raised the issue of, you know, NATO expansion and the role that played to bringing us here. And I think that is valid. It is clear that NATO played a part here in kind of, you know, the set of grievances that a lot of Russians have, not just Putin. And U.S. officials have acknowledged these concerns going back 30 years. But at the same time, I don't, you know, that does not tell us the whole story. Like I said, NATO was one of a number of grievances that have led to this. But it's clear that Putin's goals and his vision and his set of grievances are much, much broader than just that.
And to that point, in just a moment, I want to read something and just see what your knowledge is of this, because there was apparently the RIA, Novosti, the Russian, one of the Russian news agencies, had put out an essay accidentally, and right. It's now available only on a web archive. I want to read that in a moment to you, but first, just in terms of the interim period between 2014 and the past couple of weeks, what relationship between the Ukrainian government and those two regions in the Donbass? I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it quite prior.
Donetsk and Luhansk.
Right, and I've read, and it's so difficult at this point to get an assessment of attempts to cut off water supplies to those regions, the hostilities that have gone back and forth. People talk about the 14,000 people that have died in the conflict between them. What was the timing, and explain that dynamic?
Well, I think, just to put it simply, I think, as you go east in Ukraine, you see the Russian language spoken more. You see kind of what some would call ethnic Russians, or at least Russian culture, assert itself more as you get west toward Kyiv, and the western Ukraine is a much more Ukrainian, kind of nationalist Ukrainian culture. But this is not unique in the world. I think you have a lot of countries with different cultures and different languages spoken. But yes, as you move east, it does become more Russian. I think as you get east into these regions, also you do have some people who would probably prefer to be part of Russia, or at least orient Ukraine more toward Russia than toward Europe. And I think people have raised certain steps the Ukrainian government has taken that were viewed as hostile to some of these peoples in eastern Ukraine. But, you know, the answer to these problems is not to invade Ukraine and take these regions. It is to try and promote a more pluralistic democracy for all its people.
We have Quebec and Canada.
Right.
Actually, a different language, than the rest of Canada. But what has been, to the extent that there's been hostilities in those areas, and I'm not talking about this as a justification for an invasion where you're bombing civilians, but just so that people have an awareness of that dynamic. What steps did the Ukrainian government, if any, did they, in terms of, like, you know, having a chilly or a hostile relationship with those two areas?
Well, I think, you know, there were some steps like promoting, you know, Ukrainian language and Ukrainian culture that a lot of Ukrainians did support. But that, you know, again, people in the East saw as hostile and exclusionary. Again, this is not unique to Ukraine, but I would also say that part of this was driven quite intentionally by Putin himself, you know, not only by the actions that he was taken, but by clearly, you know, efforts to politically manipulate, you know, the people of Eastern Ukraine and promote these grievances. So I think that that is very much worth keeping in mind.
And in terms of Kharkiv, given its relative proximity to the eastern separatist regions, mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps I'm jumping a bit ahead here, but like, what were the underlying assumptions that Putin and the Russians had in now that they're assaulting Kharkiv to this degree? No. Like, did they overplay their hand and think, okay, because there's more Russian speaking people here, they're a little bit more culturally Russian, they'll greet us as liberators? Was that a bit of the the belief there?
Yeah, I think that is an appropriate comparison, because it does seem that, you know, I mean, a number, and again, I'm not a military expert, but I think, you know, I've seen a number of military experts commenting on the complete, you know, just the incompetence of this invasion from the get-go in terms of supply lines, in terms of strategy and tactics, but also in terms of Putin and people who know and watch him much very closely. I mean, he, over the course of the last 2 years of COVID, has just apparently become much, much more isolated. Hears from a much, much smaller number of people. You know, and certainly he would not be, as your reference indicates, he would not be the first president to launch an extremely stupid war of choice that did not go very well. But yeah, I think that what we're seeing over the past, you know, it's almost a week starting tomorrow, is, yeah, this has gone much, much more slowly and grindingly than Putin appears to have thought. And not only in terms of the advances, but in terms of the troops themselves, who I think there's evidence we're seeing that they were not aware of what they were actually being asked to do in the first place. You know, why are we being sent to Ukraine as they're being confronted? I saw a video a couple of days ago of a Russian troop in a village in eastern Ukraine, where he's just sitting on a doorstep, you know, with his head in his hands, surrounded by Ukrainian villagers who are just berating him and asking him, why have you come to make war on our country? What are you doing? So again, you don't want to overstate that, but I think those images, you know, and some of the news we're seeing about that indicates that, you know, Putin's thought this was going to be a much, much more different operation. They could do this fairly quickly and easily without the Russian people ever experiencing any of the news or the blowback or the costs of this invasion. And that very much appears not to be going his way.
I mean, this is the thing that I find really stunning about this. I mean, is that both the failure in sort of awareness as to how they would be greeted by Ukrainians, a misunderstanding of how this attack would be greeted by the rest of the world, which I guess, you know, yeah, follows naturally. I mean, if you think you're going to just walk in and mm-hmm. Kharkiv is going to shower you with candy and flowers, then of course, maybe you don't see, you know, a woman, you know, a reporter crying to Boris Johnson. Maybe you don't see, you know, Disney saying we're not going to do, you know, mm-hmm. that's terribly relevant, but it's indicative of like sort of broad pressure. But it also seems like there was no preparation whatsoever amongst the Russian people. You know, like, I mean, we remember the buildup to the Iraq war. Mm-hmm. There was a complete misunderstanding of how we would be received in Iraq.
Right.
The Bush administration was quite adept at building support within this country. It took about a year and a half of them just sort of like, you know, really building step by step.
Right.
It was a complete house of cards, and people, I think, certainly had the opportunity to see that it was being fabricated, but they were fabricating it. That doesn't seem to have happened.
That's a really great point and an important difference in this whole process, right? There was a very, very aggressive effort in the United States by the Bush administration to kind of fashion and shape a consensus in favor of the war, where, you know, whereas with Putin, all you really saw was this very bizarre broadcast meeting with his national security advisors, you know, where he's sitting across the room and they're sitting like 20 or 30 feet away from him in this, you know, a couple rows of chairs, where he's going to them one by one, asking them, hey, tell me about, you know, what do you think about my great idea of launching this ridiculous war? And they're all basically just like, you know, we think it's pretty good, while they are clearly terrified and nervous.
You played a clip of somebody yesterday.
Yeah.
Who stood up? I think it was a long time sort of intelligence, yeah. Who said, maybe we should negotiate and give him one more chance. He said, you're not really saying that, are you? Yeah. No, I'm not saying that.
No, he evinced the tiniest bit of caution, and Putin made sure to just humiliate him.
Oh, yeah.
In front of everyone else, just to make sure that everyone knew what the correct answer was.
We could hear his heart breaking through the screen, beads of sweat.
Pooling. Exactly, like you could almost see him sort of like honey, take the kids, get into the and
yeah. But all that to say, I mean, that was the extent of the consensus building that appears to have gone on.
I want to get to that sort of the denouement on that question, which is, you know, is he a lunatic? But I want to read this from the RIA Novosti. This is the Russian news agency. It purports to have been printed. People have it from the Web Archive because they pulled it down after they printed it. They published it accidentally. Do you have any before I just read a little portion of it? Do you have any sense of the validity of this, or is it? I mean, is it one of those things like we don't know?
I mean, I don't. But you know, I like you, I saw a lot of people referencing it. So
all right, let me just read a little bit of it. I mean, again. In these contexts, very hard to, this would be a very nuanced piece of disinformation that would be put out, mm-hmm. but certainly, it is, so this is a piece, The Offensive of Russia in the New World, and it talks about, Russia is restoring its unity, the tragedy of 1991, which echoes what Putin said publicly.
Yes. Right.
This terrible catastrophe in our history, its unnatural dislocation has been overcome. Yes, at great cost. Yes, through the tragic events of a virtual civil war, because now brothers separated by belonging to Russian and Ukrainian armies are still shooting at each other, but there will be no more Ukraine as anti-Russia. And it goes on to say, Vladimir Putin has assumed, without a drop of exaggeration, a historic responsibility by deciding not to leave the solution of the Ukrainian question to future generations. After all, the need to solve it would always remain the problem for Russia for two key reasons.
Right.
And the first was they mentioned national security and the implication of the expansion of NATO, but it would also be the complex of a divided people, the complex of national humiliation when the Russian house first lost its part of its foundation, Kiev, as they call it, and then forced to come to terms with the existence of two states, not one, but two peoples. Talking about the reunification of the Russian Empire, not the Soviet Union, but the Russian Empire. And he even threatened, I guess, Finland, if Finland became a member of NATO, which, of course, was part of that original Russian Empire. What is the sense of what happens? What is the sense of Vladimir Putin in terms of like being a rational actor? Like, you know, I've grown up with Gaddafi is a madman. Saddam Hussein's a madman. You know, Arafat's a madman. Just a series of madmen who are complete lunatics, not rational. And therefore we can't, you know, so I'm a little bit sensitive to the idea of labeling foreign leaders who are not doing what we want them to do as madmen. But it seems like Putin isn't. I mean, how rational of a player he is he? We can't know for sure. But I want to get your sense of what the assessment is amongst, you know, folks like yourself. And then if we deem him to be not terribly rational, how do people approach that?
That's right. I mean, those are good questions. I mean, I think there's, you know, what do we mean by rational? I mean, is he peeing in jars? You know, I don't think so. I mean, you can be rational, but have absolutely batshit goals. Right. And it seems to me that's sort of where we are here. That editorial, you know, compared to the speech we saw from Putin and, you know, also going back a year ago to this article, this historical article he published, you know, laying out some of that previously, it's pretty consistent. And I think especially what that article you just read said about Putin is the one who solved the Ukraine problem for future generations. I think I've heard this from others who watch Putin much more closely. It's like, well, let's think where he is. He's about 70 years old. He's got maybe 10 more years of rule. It does make some sense that this is the time when he would want to dispose of, you know, as he might see it, the Ukraine question, and just deal with it and establish his legacy as the new Peter the Great or whomever. So again, from Putin's possible perspective, trying to get into his head, I know others who are much more expert on this person have suggested this. But yeah, going to what you said, I mean, yes, I think this is a crazy set of goals, but he can be going about it rationally, if incompetently. He's making the wrong calculations, as it clearly he is too. But then the question is, okay, what's his end game? What will it take to get him to climb down? What are the possible off-ramps here from escalation? And that, I think, is part of what is concerning here, is that he does not seem to have left himself any.
Well, Sam just mentioned Finland, and I think that that's a good way to start talking about, like, maybe what are some of his goals, because there's some parallels in that. I believe it was the Winter War, right, where the Soviet Union... they invaded Finland. It didn't go so well. Finns were wearing white camouflage uniforms. Soviets stuck out in red in the winter. It was on their home turf. The initial invasion was
never do that.
Right. I know. I mean, well, but this is in Ukraine, which is a much larger country. They're seeing some of this, some of the difficulties of fighting on someone's home turf. Right. But in the end, the USSR was just too powerful at that point. And they did get some of Finland's territory, and they were able to, or I think it was Stalin, was able to annex some portions. So is that the blueprint more that you would say you think Putin's probably going for?
No, I mean, I think that's a really good point, because even though we are still not even a week into this invasion, or this, you know, further invasion of Ukraine, Russia, at last I've heard, has still committed only 2/3 of its force. Maybe it's more by now. But at last count, I think some have estimated they had close to 200,000 troops in play, only 2/3 of those committed. I have not really seen anyone who thinks that they will not eventually succeed. And the question is, well, what then? We don't know how long it will take. It will be cruel and bloody and horrible. And of course, the Ukrainians will fight courageously. But given, you know, even if, you know, the Russian military is behaving poorly, I think that the numbers they have, the equipment they have, could eventually do the job. The question is, again, what then?
I mean, well, that's my point. So what constitutes succeed?
Right.
I mean, because I mean, they could go in and what I've read was that the initial and again, who knows? But this is what seems to be broadly the consensus, that Putin thought he would come in. Kharkiv would fall in an afternoon. They would march on Kiev. They would kill Zelensky and his family, or just, because they don't want, a leader in exile. And they would put in a more sympathetic regime, towards Russia. But even if they were able to do that at this stage, it appears to me that they're dealing with an ongoing insurgency. And my understanding is, like, you know, when the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968, they had more than 200,000 troops.
Yeah.
Czechoslovakia is a smaller country.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soviet Union was, you know, only 20 years out from fighting World War II. I mean, this was not a military force where, you know, its soldiers were like, what am I doing here? They seemed to know what they were doing there.
Yeah.
It's unclear to me that even if they are able to get to that point where they initially thought they could, that they have achieved anything that is going to be durable in any way. So then the question really becomes, like, what is there any sense that if, like I think what Emma was suggesting, if they are, that Putin could say, all right, well, really what our real agenda has been is to annex those places in the Donbass and also to have, and that's what we really want. Or we want to create, we want Odessa is there a scenario where he can get less than Ukraine? And like you say, like, is that an off-ramp?
Yeah. At this point, I really don't think so, both because of what he's done, but also in what he's said. Taking an eastern chunk of Ukraine does not solve his problem. It leaves him with a much more radicalized and much more pro-Europe and pro-NATO Ukraine. We even just saw earlier a few hours ago with Zelensky applying for fast-tracked membership to the European Union and receiving it. I mean, this is now in play. You know, Putin all along has essentially created the outcome that he claims to fear.
That's what's so amazing about this is that, I mean, this seems to be so predictable. You've got people who are, skeptical about NATO going like, well, maybe there is a reason for NATO.
But maybe he's arrogant enough and he feels like the Russian forces are large enough. He doesn't see the U.S. mobilizing to sustain an occupation in Ukraine and then both annex those two separatist regions and ensure, like with in the case of Finland, a neutral state in Ukraine, which seems like a huge, huge ask. And, if he wants to go even further, have a pro-Putin leader as the head of state as opposed to someone like Zelensky. But, there's an arrogance there that I think is inherent in a lot of imperialists, that once you wreak havoc in a region that actually things are going to work out for you in the end. Like as Sam was saying, it's just going to, or as I'm sorry, maybe you were saying this, like it, Ukraine's just going to be even more gung-ho and pro-NATO after this, especially if you annex those separatist regions.
Right. And I think part of Putin's thinking might just be, well, look at the cruelty we've witnessed, over the past decades, including the cruelty that Russia engaged in support of the Assad regime in Syria. And he's saying, well, we'll do this and the world will condemn us and they'll sanction us. And then they will just get used to it. They have to deal with us because of our energy, because we have nuclear weapons, because we're a great power. So again, I can see that kind of being part of his thinking, and also would add to this, I don't think you can overstate the fact that he has very few around him who are willing to kind of take him by the elbow and say, Vova, this is you're screwing up.
So what from the perspective of people who in this country, and we touched on this, I guess it starts with your sort of basic assumption of what you want. Of what the best case scenario is to come out of this. For some people, I think it is the best case scenario is for Putin to be irreparably weakened. For others, and I would count myself in this, is like I want the least amount of people to die and suffer through a war. But the Ukrainian people, at least to the extent that we hear them, through the channels that we hear them, want more weapons. Mm-hmm. What do you think our response should be?
I mean, I think our response right here, I think what the Biden administration has been doing to build unity with Europe and push Europe and encourage Europe to actually respond as Europe has been actually very impressive. And I'll also say this, Senator Sanders, my boss, was one of those who said, let's make every effort to avert this diplomatically. Let's be willing to address legitimate security concerns that Russia might have. And I think that was the right argument. And I actually think the Biden administration tried to do that. And I think that is worth acknowledging. I think what we saw from European allies like Macron in France, like Scholz in Germany, in their efforts to, to sit and talk with Putin and put all of these issues on the table was genuine and was very important, but it's Putin who actually made this choice. So for now, I think maintaining that unity, I think what we saw over the past few days, I'm actually it's, you know, notable how quickly we went from let's sanction Putin and his oligarchs to these massive sanctions, you know, cutting, you know, Russia off from SWIFT system, sanctioning the Russian central bank. I mean, these are very serious sanctions that, you know, have, you know, just cratered the ruble yesterday, that could cause massive, you know, real impacts on the Russian economy and the Russian people. So while I think the unity and the speed with which we've moved has been notable, I think we have to kind of pause for a moment and make sure that we are tying means to ends with regard to the sanctions that we are piling on. I would point folks to a piece by Dan Dresner in the Washington Post just today that is raising some of these really important questions that I think we have to be asking now, because I think there is a tendency in situations like this to just be like, well, let's just pile on sanctions. And when it doesn't produce the behavior change that we want, we're just going to pile on more sanctions. You know, these are serious financial and economic weapons that have serious impacts on human beings. And again, we need to find ways to put pressure on Putin, no question. But let's think through what's the situation in which we would actually talk about unwinding these sanctions. And you know, the other piece I would mention is caring for refugees. That is something that the United States has an enormous capacity to do good, that the European partners and particularly Ukraine's neighbors have an enormous capacity, and I think are already taking important steps to care for refugees coming through, trying to keep corridors open, et cetera. And, you know, I think these steps are not as satisfying as some would like to see. You know, there is a tendency to imagine that, you know, well, if we would just use military power, we can solve these problems and that will kind of save the day. But I think I would caution against that tendency, as painful as some of these things that we are seeing are and will continue to be. I think just trying to promote a more serious conversation about how we can actually do good. And as you said, Sam, the ultimate goal is here. Let's have fewer dead people rather than more.
And just to be clear on that, on the sanctioning of Russia, that the immiserating the Russian people as a leverage point is equally inhumane as the immiseration of Ukrainian people. I mean, the idea is to mitigate suffering.
Right. And I mean, I think there's an argument for, you know, kind of sanctions and boycotts, et cetera, when you're talking about, you know, a population that actually has a say in how it's governed. That is not the case in Russia.
Right. I think that is a really important distinction that we should keep in mind. And lastly, you know, there's, I hope, but I fear there's going to be a tremendous, you know, that there's not, but I fear there's going to be a tremendous amount of tragedy that we're going to be watching in the coming days and weeks, and hopefully not longer than that, but possibly. But there also seems to be at least a somewhat of a reckoning of, we've done a good job, you know, from Europe and in the context of the United States, we've done a good job of paying attention to you know, the suffering and the of the Ukrainian people and the acceptance of refugees. What are the chances that you know, we're able to apply that lesson to people who are not white?
Right. I don't know the answer to that, but I think we got to keep raising it because it's essential. I think the kind of some of the comments we've been seeing from reporters and analysts to that point, like, well, this is different. They're white. This is, you know, quote unquote, a civilized country, which, you know, if Baghdad and Aleppo are not civilized, I mean, these are foundational to the civilizations of the world. So,
is
yeah, I think
cradle of civilization.
Absolutely. I mean, yes. And I, you know, so yeah, I think continuing to press that, I mean, when we talk about accepting refugees, as Senator Sanders has called, not only supporting Europeans in accepting, but committing to accept them here, that should apply to Ukrainians and everyone else, including from the Middle East, including from Afghanistan, including from, you know, from the Western Hemisphere. This is part of who we are as the United States. That's what he believes. That's what I believe. But just stepping back, what you said about, you know, Europe, I do think it's important for listeners to understand, like, what we have seen over the past days from Europe is amazing. And we're still, you know, this is definitely a new era in terms of Europe. What we saw just particularly from Germany, like that speech from Scholz, I think it was Saturday, where Germany broke from decades of, you know, I won't call it pacifism. Some people call it pacifism, but, you know, a foreign policy that did not, would not engage in war, would not provide weapons, would look for all kinds of other tools to you know, advance security. Now going to be, you know, doubling its defense budget, meeting its, you know, NATO, you know, going over the 2% NATO requirement. You know, I think this can't really be overstated what a significant shift this is on the part of Europe stepping up here. You know, and well, it's just a sign of, you know, this really is a shift in U.S.-Europe relationships and the way Europe looks to its own regional security.
Matt Duss, foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Great to see you, Sam. Great to see you, Emma.
All right, folks. Just want to one note. Listener Ronald Reagan has tweeted out, I think I retweeted it the other night, Yakima Abogado. We will put that on the blog. If you are, I know we have listeners in Germany. There's a family that is in Ukraine. The family members speak German. They are trying to get to Germany. If you have any opportunities for them there, you can reach out to Yakima Abogado and let them know. We'll put a link to that on the blog. Also, just a reminder, it is your support that keeps this show going. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you get the fun half every day that we do it, which is just about every day.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget, you can also become a member of the Discord. Now over 5,000 of you are on the Discord discussing things, organizing, sometimes providing mutual aid. It's a great community. Check it out. Doesn't cost you anything. MajorityDiscord.com. Just sign up and listen to this show on its app. Can I am the show via the app at MajorityApp.com. Also free. Again, if you want to stream our show from Brooklyn on March 26th, you can do so by going to Majority Live and clicking through, and you can get tickets there. But if you go and sign up for the AM Quickie, tomorrow's AM Quickie, you will see a coupon code that will save you over 50%.
Wow.
It's crazy. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckie and Media universe?
Yeah, on Sunday we released for patrons a talk with historian Mark Kruger about the St. Louis Commune of 1877 when workers used the general strike and the rail strike of 1877 to take over the city of St. Louis and how that happened. It's a very, very interesting story about how the specter of communism wasn't just haunting Europe in the 19th century, but also the heartland of America. Patreon.com/leftreckoning.
I have yet to listen to that episode, but I'm going to. But I am, like, you know, I think most people are aware that I am of the mind that those sort of, like, you know, small changes bring about bigger changes. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's in the context of what the radical Republicans were doing. Once people start getting the ideas.
Many of them were like radical union members. And, you know, they were just asking for things like eight hour workday and no child labor and stuff like that. It wasn't like they were a lot of the German immigrants were influenced by Marx, but the radicalism wasn't really evident in the demands of the way they like, you know, give us what we want as far as wages and stuff.
But my sense is that when people get a small taste of something, it raises their expectations and their demands. And, you know, so when you see, you know, something like the Build Back Better bill, I am convinced that that would have, you know, continued momentum for people. You give people universal pre-K and they start talking about daycare and they start talking about daycare and they start talking about 4-day work weeks and they, and on and on and on. I think that's where it happens.
It's like cultivating a sort of secure democratic populace.
Yes. All right, folks. So you 646-257-3920. Oh, I just dunking on Majority Report. Just bought one ticket for the streaming show for my husband and me. That's right. One ticket because we're watching it together. Thanks for the free ticket, suckers.
Actually, I'm on the intellectual property police, so I'll be paying you a visit later.
Yep. That's right.
We were just talking about that. Letter from the government.
That's right. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males, psych,
fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.